May it please the court, John James, on behalf of plaintiff below, AT&T Corp, appellant here today. As I understand it, we're going to introduce our many co-counsel before we begin today with the court's permission. And I'll start with my client, AT&T Corp. First, from the firm of Morgan Lewis and Bacchius, David Holbrecht, from the Los Angeles office, also from the same firm, John Bala. Mr. Bala will be presenting the argument on behalf of AT&T today. And also from Morgan Lewis, New York office, Christopher Lober.
Morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jack Phillips on behalf of the defendant's appellees. I'm going to introduce three different people to you. We're three lawyers are going to argue on behalf of the appellees. First is going to be Doug Mangle from the Drinker Biddle firm in Washington. Second will be Bill Larson of the D'Amato Lynch firm. And third will be Randall Block of the Sedgwick Decker firm. So and they've all been moved pro hoc, and those orders have been signed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. In this case, the trial court committed several fundamental errors that warrant reversal of its order granting summary judgment to the insurers on two substantial underlying lawsuits. One was Williamson, which was a $3 billion creditors claim that was settled for $400 million, and the second was Lakin, a federal securities class action. The trial court's first fundamental error was that it incorrectly held that a lawsuit could contain only a single claim. This, in our view, puts form over substance. The courts in each of the controlling jurisdictions hold that a claim as defined in these insurance policies is a demand for damages. If a plaintiff chooses to join several discrete, independent, unrelated demands for damages into a single complaint, then in our view and under the cases, those are still independent claims. Merely joining them in a single pleading does not make them a single claim, as the trial court held.
Could I interrupt you on that point?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Frequently, plaintiffs claim a variety of misrepresentations or omissions in a proxy statement, for example. Would it be your position that the collection of all misrepresentations and omissions constitutes one claim, or that each individual alleged misstatement constitutes a claim?
It depends on the circumstances, and it depends on consideration of two sets of policy terms. The insuring agreements for these policies provide coverage for a claim for a wrongful act. So it is at least theoretically possible that a claim could arise from each of the independent misrepresentations or omissions. However, these policies also say, as most do, that claims that arise out of related wrongful acts or interrelated wrongful acts, depending on the different policies, are deemed to be a single claim. In the case of Your Honor's questions, if there is a question, if there is a series of misrepresentations that deal with the same subject matter and arise from the same underlying wrongful conduct. Example, a single set of accounting errors that affected the financials in a number of ways. In our view, while that could lead to several different misstatements or misrepresentations, the underlying conduct from which they derive would be the same, and so that would be one claim. Conversely, in the case, for instance, in the Home versus Spectrum case, there were different misrepresentations that arose from different underlying conduct, issues about a licensing agreement or issues about accounting. And in that circumstance, in our view, there would be multiple claims. The point here as to the number of claims is not how many different misrepresentations are alleged, but what the true wrongful conduct is and what the substance of the wrongful conduct is.
And, well, is there going to be a deductible that gets applied to each claim as you've defined it?
In the case of what is known as Side A coverage, non-indemnifiable loss, no. In the case of Side B coverage, which would be indemnifiable loss, there is.
There would be, actually eliminate any coverage altogether then?
Not in this case, Your Honor. In this case, when we look at the Williamson and Lakin pleadings, we find four independent claims in Williamson, only one of which would relate back to the earlier policy period, and we only find two claims in Lakin, one of which would relate back to the independent policy, to the earlier policy period.
How many demands for money were made in those cases? Was there a single demand?
No. In the Williamson case, there were 11 causes of action. Each of those causes of action contained a demand for money. They contained a specific allegation that the wrongful acts that gave rise to that cause of action damaged At Home and its shareholders and creditors. Now, some of those 11 causes of action obviously relate to common conduct. For instance, there were multiple causes of action about the misappropriation of technology, and those all collapsed to one claim. But in our view, there were multiple demands for damages in both cases.
So there was each count had its own addendum clause?
It did not have the specific number in the complaint, except in a few instances, but they all specifically said the wrongful acts at issue that gave rise to this cause of action damaged the company and the shareholders and creditors in an amount to be determined at trial. And so we view those as, just as the courts in Checkwright and Home Spectrum and the other cases we cited, those are independent demands for damages and hence separate claims. Indeed, as the Williamson case developed and as the pleadings went further, it became clear that the damage claim in Williamson ultimately related to the zone of insolvency claims, particularly count one, the breach of fiduciary duty, while in the zone of insolvency. And so the demand for damages in Williamson ultimately evolved to that theory. The complaint, however, certainly contains independent demands for damages for each count.
Let me make sure I understood you. Is it your position that if we were to agree with your view and reverse on this issue, that we would be saying that there are four claims under Williamson and two under Lakin, and that's it?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The four claims under Williamson are, first, the zone of insolvency claims that dealt with the build-or-buy strategy, the delay of the bankruptcy filing, and the Section 363 offer. That's one claim. Second claim for misappropriation of the technology. Third claim for the financing and financial condition issues. And the fourth being the March 2000 transaction challenge. And that's the only one that, in our view, deals with related or interrelated wrongful acts and would relate back to the earlier period. On Lakin, we would have two claims, one being the scheme to misappropriate the technology, and the second being the misrepresentations and omissions in the various public statements and public filings about the company's financials, about its prospects, about its expenses, et cetera. So those are the six
claims.
And both
of those, you contend, would survive?
We think the second would certainly survive. We think there is an open question as to whether the first would survive. The Lakin pleadings are not very specific, and they're not very detailed, and the case was dismissed on motion, so there's not a full pleading record on that. But certainly the second claim we think survives.
Thank you.
With respect to the trial court's errors, Your Honor, back to the claim issues, we believe the trial court's decision on the claim point really leaves the insurance coverage totally to the whim of the pleading plaintiffs. Good example is Williamson. As I've already said, Williamson dealt with four claims, and those were four claims that were assigned by the bankruptcy court to the Williamson trustee. If the Williamson trustee had asserted four separate lawsuits, we wouldn't be in this position. The trial court's holding and the insurers would say those are four independent claims. And simply by joining them in a single complaint, the trustee unknowingly deprived AT&T of insurance coverage, and that's a totally random and arbitrary result. In turn, though, we think the claim issue determination really led to the court's second fundamental error. Because once the trial court concluded that Williamson and Lake and the entire suit could only be a single claim, all the court did was look to see if there were any common facts between those two claims and two earlier claims that had been asserted during the earlier policy period. Those two earlier cases were Pittleman and San Mateo. In our view, that's not the correct analysis, because what the cases require is for the court to examine the different demands for damages that were alleged in Williamson and Lakin to see if those demands involve wrongful acts that were not related to those asserted in the earlier cases. And the trial court really never conducted any of that analysis, and the case should be reversed for that reason alone. Looking at the earlier cases.
Let me interrupt again. I realize that the parties didn't address this point, and I'm not trying to waylay the argument too far, but I'm a little bit curious about this. Weren't these policies purchased at a time when the insured knew that it had some serious litigation problems ahead and behind? what I'm getting at is that one would think that when you buy significant insurance coverage at a time when there already are existing lawsuits and claims and potentially more to come, that the parties would be extraordinarily clear about what their coverage would protect them from and what it wouldn't. And yet there doesn't seem to be any argument that, well, if we could get to extrinsic evidence, we would be able to establish that the parties clearly intended this to be covered.
Well, Your Honor, I think your point is certainly well taken. There was significant litigation in the earlier policy period that's unrelated to the four cases that we're talking about on this appeal that themselves are likely to completely exhaust the limits of those first policies. From AT&T's standpoint, it felt it was being extraordinarily careful to try to procure additional coverage. It bought a runoff program, for instance, to deal with claims arising from past prior acts with an entirely separate and new set of limits for millions of dollars. Bought the 2001 and 2002 programs, again, for millions of dollars. The insurer certainly could have put in very specific endorsements and exclusions about anything they wanted in terms of prior acts, specific transactions, or any sort of broad language about that, and they didn't do that. Instead, they have relatively standard boilerplate exclusions. The trial court in this case reserved and did not decide the issue of whether these exclusions contradicted the reasonable expectations of the parties in procuring this coverage. That's still an open question, but it certainly bears on Your Honor's point because the insurers are trying to take a very narrow view of this coverage when the policy language simply doesn't support that. And it particularly doesn't support it when one looks at these four cases in context and completely, instead of trying to see if there are simply any common factors. There's really no dispute that Pittleman and San Mateo were very narrowly focused cases. They challenged the March 2000 transaction and only the March 2000 transaction. When the trial court described the allegations of Williamson and Lakin, in its opinion, it only listed those allegations that were about the March 2000 transaction. And if you look at the footnotes, you'll see that it only cited those particular paragraphs and nothing more. And as a result, it simply held, only looking for common facts, that transaction spawned all of the litigation and tied all of the four cases together. When you look at Williamson and Lakin in detail and in context, you'll see that the trial court really ignored all of the facts that contradicted its holding. In Williamson, there were only one of the 11 causes of action had anything to do with the March 2000 transaction. Only 20 of the 203 factual allegations had anything to do with it. And as I said before, it was based on the assignment of four claims to the trustee. Only one of those had anything to do with the transaction. Indeed, the specific wrongful acts that are pled in Williamson really constitute
a... Is it your position then that the March 2000 transaction is completely irrelevant to all these other claims?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's not my position. It is the way the Williamson complaint is pled in that regard, and let me explain.
Well, if it wasn't the March 2000 transaction included in the pleadings?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The March 2000 transaction was included in the Williamson and Lakin pleadings. In Williamson, it was only one cause of action out of 11.
Well, doesn't that, okay, so you're saying it's only related to that one cause of action and not any other?
That's correct. And indeed, that's the way the Williamson complaint is pled. When the trustee was very careful to plead Williamson as a series of multiple independent decisions by the board over a two-year period, the March 2000 transaction was only one example and one wrongful act that was alleged. They alleged the Project 90 issue, the trade secrets, the financing transaction, the new CEO issues, the builder buy and bankruptcy issues, and none of those have anything to do with the March 2000 transaction. The trustee did not plead Williamson as part of sort of a common scheme or pled that March 2000 caused all of the others. In fact, in paragraph 6 of the amended Williamson complaint, the trustee makes clear that none of the other acts take place if the directors had simply met their fiduciary obligations.
Let me just make sure that I understand the thrust of your position. If, as you argue, the Superior Court erred in defining claim to, that is equating claim with lawsuit, that would not be a reversible error if the exclusions applied, correct?
No, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because the claim determination permeated the rest of the analysis. In other words, the exclusions tie claim and wrongful act together. So when you look at, if you were to look at the lawsuit as one claim, then if there were any common facts, the exclusion would apply.
Well, if the operation of the exclusion correctly basically ties the subsequent lawsuits to the prior lawsuits, then you would lose anyway. Your argument is that they don't.
That's correct.
That is,
and our argument is that they don't because the court would need to look at it claim by claim.
By claim, and by doing so, at most, it would find only one claim in Williamson and one claim in Lakin to be excluded on that basis.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
But the other claims would not be excluded under any of the various exclusions.
Not at all, Your Honor.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use, but you could. I just wanted to remind you.
If it pleases the court, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Douglas Mangle. I'm presenting argument on behalf of the carriers who participated in the runoff and 2001 to 02 towers, which I'll refer to collectively as the 2001 policies. I intend to yield 8 minutes to National Union to address its 2002 policy, and they will in turn yield approximately 2 minutes to counsel for Zurich. I'd like to start with this notion of how many claims there are, Your Honor. If you go back and through the journey of AT&T's arguments on this issue, you will first see that in oral argument before Judge Jordan, she specifically asked them how many claims there were on the exact same fact record, and their response was at least 17. Today is the first time in the course of this litigation that they have conclusively identified both the number of claims and the rationale for getting there. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to spend a minute or two going through their various statements on this with specific cites, because I think it's most instructive on the havoc that their theory would wreak on claims-made insurance.
Wait a second. Are you going to talk about the four claims that they're talking about now or some larger number?
A larger number, Your Honor. What I'll talk about is the various statements they've made at various points in this proceeding about how many claims there are in their theories behind it.
But but if you've persuaded them that they should be looking at it more collectively, why not deal with what their current position is?
Well, because I think it shows the difficulty in applying their position, and frankly, it is relevant. I mean, you'll see, if you'll allow me, that they have at times made arguments that there might be up to 77 claims in this lawsuit. First, let's talk about their theory as to what constitutes a claim. They initially argued, contrary to what they just argued before you, that each misrepresentation standing alone is a distinct claim. Then they argued, and you can find this at page 33 of their opening brief, that a misrepresentation that results in a demand is a distinct claim. Then, if we move to their reply brief at page 14, they assert that each cause of action constitutes a claim, and that each cause of action can further be broken down based on the number of defendants. Then two pages later in the same reply brief, they say that claims are determined by grouping together different categories of fact allegations. When they try to apply these theories, they've gotten all different kinds of results. With respect to Lakin, they initially said that there were at least 15 claims, and you can find that at Judge Jordan's opinion at page 37. Then they said in the reply brief that there were 5 claims that can potentially be multiplied to 25 based on the number of defendants. Then they suggested, finally, 2 pages later, that there may be only 2 distinct claims in Lakin. With Williamson, they first said vaguely that there were numerous claims. They refused to identify them. Then they said there were at least 23 claims, and that's their joint, you can find the cite to that in our joint answering brief at page 16. They then said in the reply brief there were 11 claims that could be multiplied to 77, possibly, based on the number of defendants. It's frankly farcical, and it makes a mockery of the most fundamental element of claims-made coverage, we think, which is identifying the claim. The other principal problem with their theory is that it may advance their interests in this particular case, but it's a terrible idea in general. Claims-made policies often have substantial deductibles, and these deductibles, as Judge Justice Richley noted, apply on a per-claim basis. If each lawsuit, as they previously suggested, could be divided into 15, 20, or more claims, coverage would often be illusory because in most cases the deductibles would eclipse the amount at stake. You'll hear from Mr. Larson, I believe, in a few minutes, that they have a $10 million deductible under the National Union policy. Would any insured expect that each wrongful act or each group of claims in a complaint would be subject to a separate $10 million retention? I highly doubt it. And on a practical basis, if we continue to think this through, if there can be multiple claims based on, let's take AT&T's current argument, different groupings of allegations, how in the world do you apply the multiple deductibles to the different claims? Law firms don't break down their invoices by particular categories of claims in a lawsuit. Lawsuits typically don't settle by allocating amounts to particular groups of causes of action. And frankly, if they did, it would in all likelihood raise issues of collusiveness. It's a completely impractical standard to apply. The correct approach, as is usually the case, is to just apply the straightforward language in our policy. Our policy definition of claim has 2 prongs. The first is a demand for damages or other relief, and the second is a civil proceeding. AT&T says that even though Williamson and Lakin are civil proceedings, the court should have applied the first prong of the definition and treated each action as having multiple demands for damages. But that would render the second prong completely superfluous, because every civil proceeding necessarily involves one or more demands for damages.
Well, if there are 2 possible constructions of that, why shouldn't the one in favor of the insured apply?
Well, I think, first of all, Your Honor, if you look at that provision, I think a common sense interpretation is that a civil proceeding can constitute a claim, and that a written or oral demand for damages that does not rise to the level of a civil proceeding can also constitute a claim. The unreasonable interpretation is that one prong completely swamps the other. But I would turn to the case law in part to answer your question. And AT&T says we haven't cited a single case from any jurisdiction stating that a complaint as a whole constitutes a claim. We have. The irony is that they cite such a case and they don't even realize it. They rely heavily in their reply brief on the Checkwright case. And in the Checkwright had a number of different components within it. In the first part of the Checkright case, which they cite, the court said, and the court in Checkright analyzed a claim provision that was essentially identical to ours. In the first part of the case, the court said that a second amended complaint could in theory constitute a distinct claim from the initial complaint. Then the court went off and discussed a notice issue. Then they came back to this issue, and frankly, I'm not sure they read the second part of it, because the second part of Checkright says the insurer got tried to push a little bit there, tried to implicate more coverage beyond just getting coverage for the second amended complaint. What the insurer tried to say is that, okay, let's look at the second amended complaint. We think we can divide it up into multiple claims. And the court said, absolutely not. That second amended complaint is a single proceeding and a single unitary demand. If they want to live by Checkright, they should die by Checkright. That's what Checkright holds. The Community Foundation that we cite reaches the same result. The cases, the Lexstar case, reaches the same result. All of the cases that they cite involve a fundamentally different definition of claim. It's a claim that is a demand for monetary relief or for money damages, and then as a subset of that, it has a civil proceeding.
So if we accept your argument, then the fortuity of whether a plaintiff decides to file separate actions or combine in one complaint several causes of action is going to control the coverage?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that clearly if a plaintiff were to plead two completely unrelated causes of action, if there was a tort action, for instance, a plaintiff was complaining someone punched him in the nose, and then there was a second part of the case that involved a completely unrelated business transaction, I think those two claims would be severed. And the severed action would constitute a second claim. And the question would be, does it relate back? But I think that when you look at the relation back, we haven't even talked about this, when you talk about the broad language in the relation back provisions in our policy, it makes it very clear that the parties are seeking clarity. You could not find provisions that more broadly state that if there is any nexus between a second action and a first action, that the whole thing pushes back. And there may be circumstances such as this, rare circumstances such as this, where the insured is not going to like that, but these provisions also work to the insured's benefit. It works to their benefit in that it avoids the stacking of retentions. It works to their benefit in the sense that if you have a claim that's first made after your policy expires, if there's a broad relationship between that and a previously filed claim, it comes back, and the carrier is going to be deemed to be a claim made during the policy period, and the carrier is going to be responsible for that.
What would happen if we were to disagree with your argument concerning the definition of claim?
And you accepted the argument there were multiple claims within a lawsuit?
Correct.
Then, Your Honor, I think you have to look at whether those claims within a claim, if you will, were related to the prior litigation. And here, the AT&T is trying to, they're focusing mostly on the Williamson action, and we think that that there is a sufficient nexus even under that theory.
But your opponent says that trial judge did not do that analysis.
I think that analysis, she didn't need to do that analysis strictly speaking, Your Honor, but I think that she was very clear within her analysis that there was enough of a nexus between the constituent parts. First of all, they never made this argument to Judge Jordan, four claims, two claims. But the Williamson and the Lakin action, for instance, explicitly identify the March 2000 transactions in an ongoing series of events that encompass all of the supposedly unrelated allegations. And if I don't have the complaint handy, but if there's one paragraph of Williamson that I would point you to, it's a paragraph up front which sets forth what the case is about. It's paragraph 5. And what paragraph 5 says is that there was this ongoing plan, scheme, if you will, for AT&T to take control of At Home and exercise that control to the disadvantage of At Home. And the March 2000 transaction, which incidentally is not just an attachment to Williamson, it's the only exhibit to Williamson. The March 2000 transaction, as characterized in that pleading, is the linchpin of the Williamson action. But for that transaction, we don't have to satisfy a but-for test, but for that transaction, nothing else would have followed.
you're using your co-counsel's time here.
I'd like to yield, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am William Larson. I'm from the firm of DeMato & Lynch, and I represent National Union in this matter. National Union, of course, joins the positions that have been articulated by Mr. Mangle and the other carriers on the 2001 AT&T policy tower and the runoff tower. I'm going to be focusing on my discussion on the 2002 tower in which we have the lead policy. As we know, the court below found that any one of the relation back provisions or exclusions in those policies or our 2002 policy preclude coverage for AT&T here in these later towers. These provisions included the single claim provision, the prior notice exclusion, the pending and prior litigation exclusion, as well as the prior acts exclusions. The thrust of AT&T's position here is that the court below should have ignored the extensive language in these policies that limit insurance coverage to the policy or tower of policies in effect when the first claim is made by letter demand or suit or case perhaps investigation process based on the same or similar acts, that is wrongful acts, that were the basis of prior notices, litigation, or simply were prior in time to the operative prior acts exclusion. The court below was correct in enforcing all of the subject exclusions. But affirmance here is only required if the court below is correct in one of those determinations in enforcing those exclusions. The 2002 National Union
policy. Do we necessarily have to determine what is a claim in order to properly apply the exclusion?
No, Your Honor. I think Mr. Mangle went into that at the end of his discussion. I think it simplifies it if it's one claim, obviously. But if you have to go through a more elaborate process of analyzing the distinct wrongful acts ad seriatim, and there are hundreds of them, obviously it becomes a more complex task. You have a more complex task. If you have, the court did go through an elaborate process as it was, but you don't have to take them one by one necessarily, is all I'm saying. I would like to jump a little bit because we have limited time. One of the things that was mentioned in the new delineation of claims that we've heard here today is little mention of the prior acts exclusion, which is foremost in my mind. We talked about four claims, and if I understood correctly the delineation, these include the IRU financing, the March 2000 transaction, the technology appropriation, and then the insolvency situation that was described. All three of those four all took place before the prior act's continuity date. The IRU financing occurred in the spring of 2001. The technology appropriation, as described, was completed by the end of June 2001. And, of course, the March 2000 transaction had long been accomplished by that time. More importantly, when we look at the transactions or events that postdate that continuity date, and we're talking about the insolvency period and then the buy and build of a scheme for the new web portal, if we look at those, they're really nothing more, as pled, if we look at them, they're nothing more than the exploitation of what had already been done. Both the insolvency and the buy and build, they do not. The allegations contain nothing if there was no misappropriated technology, let alone the original transaction in 2000 where control was obtained, supposedly in breach of fiduciary duties.
I understand you correctly. I think what you're saying is that if we look at the four Williamson claims as articulated by AT&T, that one of them is the technology misappropriation, correct?
That's correct.
And you're saying that it's excluded not because it was related to the March 2000 transaction, but because it occurred during a time that your policy didn't provide coverage?
It occurred before the continuity date in the prior acts exclusion, which is a distinct exclusion from the prior and pending litigation and the prior notice. It operates differently. You'll see different language, not only in the sense that it's prior acts, but you also see different descriptive language in terms of the timing. But minimally, that exclusion bars all of this. I agree with our other insurers that these other exclusions also bar it, but I'm just suggesting that the prior acts is clearer and easier to get there because it draws a brighter red line down in terms of timing, and the relationship back is clearer with all those prior events. Mr. Mangold had some discussion about what is a claim. That's obviously the focus of a lot of discussion as it was below. I won't repeat that. I will note, as Mr. Mangold suggested I would, that the operation of this policy, if you adopt the AT&T's view here of what a claim is, becomes untenable if only in an application of retentions or what are also known as deductibles. Our policy has a $10 million retention. It may be an issue as whether it applies here, but it's clear it applies to such things as securities, claims. And if we're going to break down claims, as was suggested below, to 17 or 181, whatever it would be, it's a ridiculous result. And I'm not suggesting that that was intended at any time earlier. What was intended was the unitary definition of a claim in situations like this, where it would be used with respect to relation back provisions, exclusions or provision, as well as the retention provision, which I think if you look at is paragraph 8 of the policy. The AT&T also attacks the language in our exclusions in terms of the same or related. It's used in, that phrase is used in each of the exclusions that I've described. Firstly, if there is a problem with that, I suggest at least in the prior and pending litigation and the prior notice exclusion that you look at it, because that's the not the only description. You have language there in addition to that that relates to acts arising out of, based upon, or attributable to facts alleged, or to the same or related wrongful acts. Obviously, if you take same or related out of that, you still have some linking language. And we submit to the court that that linking language, even if you take same the clause, same or related out of those clauses, you still have the relation back that requires the enforcement of these two exclusions. In conclusion, the opinion of the court below should be affirmed in its entirety. The single claim provision, the prior notice exclusion, and the prior acts exclusion of the 2002 AT&T primary policy issued by the National Union are all unambiguous and enforceable. These provisions, as do the like provisions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Randall Block for Zurich American Insurance Company. We believe that the positions that the other carriers have taken are correct and that we have the benefit of those. We argue separately because Zurich's policy contains unique language. It contains unique language in connection with its prior acts exclusion, which says that coverage is excluded where all or any part of the wrongful acts giving rise to a claim were committed, attempted, or allegedly committed or attempted before the policy period began on July 9, 2001. So if all or any part of the wrongful acts that give rise to the now what we know are two claims according to plaintiffs, if all or any part of those acts occurred before July 9, 2001, then the entire claim is excluded. Let's take a look at what the allegations of the Lakin action say, which is the only action that's an issue as to the 2001-2002 tower. In February 2000, before July of 2001, in February 2000, AT&T concocted its steam project. That goes to the conversion claim that even they contend is one of two claims. In March of 2000, AT&T entered into the transactions to gain control over At Home. That's part of the conversion claim. At the same time, in March of 2000, AT&T falsely represented it was committed to the success of At Home. That's part of the misrepresentation claim, March of 2000. In June of 2000, AT&T falsely represented it would conduct open access testing. That was part of the misrepresentation claim. So even if you accept their position on the claims, it is beyond question that Zurich's policy excludes coverage for both of those claims.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, if it pleases the Court, I'd like to respond to a few of the points raised by the defendants. Specifically, starting with Mr. Mangel's points on the number of claims, we don't see an inconsistency here. As I told you earlier, the number there are certainly a gross number of claims based on each misrepresentation. When you apply the related language, you get to the smaller number. Really no inconsistency in the positions there. It's simply responses to different questions. As far as the argument that this is unworkable and makes a mockery of it, as we noted in our reply brief, these issues come up all the time about mixed claims, allocation of defense costs and settlements of uncovered and uncovered claims, covered and uncovered parties. It's an issue that insurers and policyholders and courts have been dealing with for years. This is really no different. As far as the issue of the definition of claim, Your Honors, if the insurers intended to state specifically that one lawsuit could only be one claim, they could have said that directly. Nowhere in these policies does it say that. Nowhere does it say that a demand cannot be a civil proceeding or a civil proceeding can't be a demand or that any of those elements of the claim definition are mutually exclusive. The plain language suggests otherwise. Further, the hypothetical that Mr. Mangel gave contradicts his position directly. If there's one complaint with a tort action and an unrelated business transaction, he now says that would be two claims. That's what we're saying here, and that's where the trial court, we believe, erred. As far as the Williamson claim and the related claims, I want to explain this directly because what the insurers are saying is that March 2000 permeated the whole complaint and caused everything else. And that's not what Williamson alleged. Specifically, Your Honors, paragraph 5 of the Williamson complaint lists all of the different wrongful acts and all of the different board decisions. Never says that it was part of a common scheme. You won't find that anywhere in the Williamson complaint. Simply says at every critical juncture over the two-year path, AT&T and its director designees chose what was in AT&T's best interest. And then the following paragraph says, with respect to each of those actions, March 2000, Project 90, financing, builder buy, bankruptcy, it specifically says in paragraph 3 that none of that happens if at any at one of those decisions the directors had abided by and upheld their fiduciary duties. But even more to the point, Your Honor, even when Williamson pled the March 2000 transaction specifically, it disclaimed any notion that there was a connection. And I point specifically to paragraph 148 of the amended complaint, where they said that the duties that the directors and AT&T owed to At Home existed independently and would have existed in the same way even if the transaction had not occurred, not related wrongful acts under these provisions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court appreciates the arguments and will take this matter under advisement and take a brief break.